States against Iacona. Mr. Parsons.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Ryan Parsons on behalf of Chad Iacona. This is a prosecutorial misconduct case based on the government's attempts to prop up a weak case through improper attacks at closing arguments. During the prosecutor's closing arguments, he repeatedly and erroneously attacked Mr. Iacona's trial testimony. The comments were both excessive and without a factual basis in the trial record, and as a result, the jury was poisoned into believing that Mr. Iacona was a bad guy and distracted the jury from their calm and detached search for the truth to which a criminal trial should aspire.
Do you know what it seems? It seems that what the prosecutor did was point out that Iacona's testimony was inconsistent with the evidence in the case, and that the inconsistency indicated that he was not honest. And isn't that a fair argument based on the evidence? I mean, there didn't seem to be any point at which the prosecutor stated a personal opinion as to his truthfulness, as opposed to arguments that were based on the evidence.
To be sure, the government was free to point out inconsistencies between Mr. Iacona's testimony and the testimony of other witnesses. But what the government was not free to do was to fabricate alleged inconsistencies, which is what the government did here. For example, the government claimed that Mr. Iacona testified that every single payment to the credit card company is not my signature. But that's not what Mr. Iacona testified. The government, on cross-examination, the prosecutor asked him, is it your testimony that you didn't sign any of these checks paying those accounts? And Mr. Iacona responded, I may have signed some, but most of them no. So Mr. Iacona never testified that he didn't sign any of the accounts, just that he signed some but not others. The government distorted that testimony at closing arguments. And even at sentencing then, Judge Reagan determined that Mr. Iacona did say that he signed some but not others, and that that was consistent with the evidence presented to him. And the government does that again, testifying about his general...
This sounds like the standard back and forth between counsel in cases. The government says inference A is sound, and the defense says inference A is not sound. I don't see what that has to do with an argument on appeal. It's just the standard back and forth. You try your best to make inferences, and sometimes they persuade, and sometimes they don't.
But the inference has to be based on a fair reading of the trial record, and in this case...
It has to be based on the trial record.
Certainly.
That is, it can't be based on the prosecutor's personal beliefs. But as Judge Rovner said, did the prosecutor ever say that this was some personal belief or imply that it was based on facts extrinsic to the record?
No, but he distorted the record to make the arguments.
That's what the defense always says, right? Assuming that the client isn't pleading guilty, in every criminal case, the defense will be saying the prosecutor is distorting the record or not drawing the correct inferences from the record.
That's
the standard give and take at a criminal trial.
It's not a matter of correct or incorrect. There's no evidence in the trial record from which the prosecutor could have drawn these inferences. So it's beyond the simple give and take between the prosecution and the defense.
Your current argument just sounds like a quibble. I mean, the defense counsel should have gotten up to his feet and said, the prosecutor used the word all. He should have used the phrase, almost all. And then the prosecutor might have said, yep, fine, almost all.
To be sure, the defense counsel's argument did not address the specific comments. But at the same point, he spent his entire time addressing the actual elements of the crime. It's not clear whether the defense counsel recognized that this was not based on the trial record or what, but there's still no evidence from which the prosecutor can draw the inferences that it draw. Another one, this generalized attack on Mr. Iacona's honesty. The government says you kind of get an idea about Mr. Iacona's honesty, not just here in the courtroom or on the witness stand, but his honesty in dealings with all sorts of people that he gets money from. So, again, it's a generalized attack on Mr. Iacona's honesty, but, again, it's not drawn from anything that Mr. Iacona testified to. On appeal, the government points to Mr. Iacona's conduct with other credit card companies, but, again, there's no testimony elicited by any party that Mr. Iacona did anything dishonest with those other credit card companies. He certainly drew opened accounts with them, but there's no evidence from which the court or from which the prosecutor could have drawn these inferences that it made. I mean, again, that's what happened in sentencing. The government, moved for an enhancement based on perjury, based on Mr. Iacona's lying at the trial lying on the stand. But the government determined that, the court determined that he did not lie, that his testimony was not false within the meaning of perjury, even under the lower propensity of the evidence standard.
But why would it be relevant that the district court found that he didn't perjure himself? I mean, even if that finding's seen as a rejection of the prosecutor's claim of dishonesty, a court's disagreement with the prosecutor's argument doesn't render it misconduct, does it?
It's certainly not sufficient by itself to prove misconduct, certainly. Again, the bottom line isn't whether the prosecutor's statements were absolutely correct, but whether they were a fair reading of the trial evidence. Having said that, the court was able to look at the same evidence that the prosecutor was supposedly pointing to and determined that it was not proven to the propensity of more likely than not. It should be a factor considered by the court in determining whether the statements of the prosecutor were a fair reading of the trial evidence. On the prejudice prong of the standard, the question, again, is the severity of the misconduct, whether the comments were invited by defense counsel. The government didn't present any evidence on either of these.
What the prosecutor did here was worse than what the prosecutor did in Calhoun.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with Calhoun.
Yesterday's decision by the Supreme Court involving plain error in prosecutorial statements and comments at trial.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with Calhoun, Your Honor. But at some point, given these five separate attacks, given that this was the central theme of the prosecution's closing arguments, I would argue that it does rise to the level of plain error. The comments were not invited by defense counsel. He did nothing to elicit these comments from the prosecution. The jury instructions, while there is, of course, the general presumption that the jury follows the instructions, if there were ever a case to look beyond that presumption, I mean, this is it.
That's why I asked about Calhoun.
Okay.
If there was ever a case, you might have thought it was Calhoun, but the justices agreed, all nine of them, that no, there was no plain error in Calhoun, even though the prosecutor's comments were egregious.
Okay. In this case, the jury instructions were read at the beginning of trial, but the judge consciously chose not to reread them. There was some kind of issue with the court trying to speed up the trial, so he consciously chose not to give the jury the instructions again at the close of a four-day trial. And again, of course, there was no specific instruction relative to the prosecutor's comments. I see that I've entered my rebuttal time. Unless there are further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Lewis.
May it please the Court, Catherine Lewis on behalf of the United States of America. The government respectfully requests that this court affirm the defendant's conviction. The only issue in this case is over purported errors in the government's closing argument. There was no objection at trial, so it's reviewed under a plain error standard. Under that standard, the defense has to establish that the comments were improper, that when you look at them in the full context of the trial, that the defendant was denied a fair trial, and that absent the comments, that the outcome of the trial would have been different. And in this case, the defendant has failed to establish those three things. In the first place, the comments were not improper. They're just the standard back and forth that you have at the end of a criminal trial. The defendant testified at trial, putting his credibility at issue. And when he testified, he made comments and statements that were irreconcilable with the government's witnesses and the government's evidence at trial. And so there was no way for the government to argue its case other than to say, our witnesses and our evidence are correct, and what the defendant has told you is not true, and you should consider his credibility. Here, the comments were based on the record. Some of them were harsh, but they were fair, and that's the requirement that a prosecutor may give hard or harsh criticism, but that the blows that a prosecutor strikes must be fair, and that's precisely what happened in this case. And if an inference can be drawn from the record, then it's not an error to suggest that a defendant is not credible or even to call the defendant a liar. Moving on to the second point, when it comes to the context of the full trial, the defendant got a fair trial. These comments were not severe misconduct. This court has upheld comments during closing arguments where prosecutors have called witnesses liars and slimy and bozos and stating that somebody has lied their head off. And those are certainly more egregious comments than the comments
that were made by the prosecutor. I think we have upheld the comments. We have held that the district court did not commit error in refusing to hold a second trial.
Yes, I apologize, Your Honor.
Prosecutors do a lot of things that they shouldn't in retrospect. That doesn't mean when there's no new trial that we have endorsed them.
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor. I misspoke. What I meant to say is that they found no reversible error with statements much more egregious than any of the comments that were made by the prosecutor in this case. Here the jury was properly instructed. They were told that arguments made by the attorneys are not evidence. The evidence is what was presented to them during the four-day trial. And that the defendant's credibility should be judged like the credibility of any other witness. The defense had an ability.
I take it you would agree that a defendant as a witness is entitled to different treatment, such that attacks that, you know, might be made in closing argument as to other witnesses really need to be tempered when they're directed at a defendant.
Yes, they need to be tempered, but as long as they're within that boundary of being harsh but fair, then it's completely fair to attack a defendant's credibility when he testifies, and particularly in this case where he puts on character evidence of his reputation for truthfulness. Also in this case, it's important, I mean, the defense had 45 minutes to rebut anything said in the opening part of the closing argument, so there was an ability to rebut, and here there was also strong evidence of guilt. And the outcome of the trial, absent these comments, would not have been different. A prosecutor's comments during closing argument rarely give rise to reversible error. This was a four-day trial with a significant amount of evidence, lots and lots of paperwork. They had copies of checks to look at, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of documents. The jury was properly instructed. The defendant's problem here, essentially, was that he was not a credible witness. And what he said went against the manifest weight of the evidence. And so in this case, there was no prosecutorial misconduct that should give rise to reversible error under a plain error standard. So if there are no further questions, the government will rest on its brief.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Anything further, Mr. Parsons?
Very briefly, Your Honor. Just a couple points. We would argue strongly that there was no strong evidence of guilt. With respect, the government acknowledged that there's no other way for it to argue its case other than to state that Mr. Iacona's testimony is inconsistent with the testimony of the government's witnesses. And that's certainly true, which gives the government leeway to attack Mr. Iacona's testimony. But it also suggests that the evidence against Mr. Iacona wasn't very strong because it was, at the end of the day, a he said, she said type of case. The only other point I would add is while this court certainly has upheld judgments based on or following closing arguments with egregious language, the government, you know, points to, you know, five different slanders in five different cases as opposed to this case where, you know, it was repeated attacks, you know, such as bold falsehoods and who could have imagined him lying. And he lies about basic, simple things, and that he damned himself with his false testimony. So it was very repetitive attacks against Mr. Iacona, to the point that it really did detach from, or did distract from the jury's common detached search for the truth. Unless there are further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Parsons, we thank you, and we thank your law firm for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.